From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Palestinian ceasefire was broken last night by a suicide bomber who attacked an Israeli home near the West Bank, killing an Israeli woman. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the progress and the setbacks in the new peace process with James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll also talk about the new role the Bush administration is playing in the process. And rock critic Ken Tucker continues his look at the latest in pop rock. He reviews Redhead, the new CD by the musician known as Blue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. President Bush met with regional leaders today in Senegal to discuss whether to commit U.S. troops to a peacekeeping force in Liberia. NPR's Don Gagne is traveling with the president and says no decision has been made yet.
The president told reporters in Senegal here that the White House is now in the process of determining the extent of U.S. participation in any potential future international peacekeeping force there. The president did stress again, though, that Charles Taylor, the president of Liberia, must leave. And he also said that the United Nations will indeed be involved in Liberia in making sure there is a peaceful transition of power.
NPR's Don Gagne in Dakar, Senegal. The president is now in South Africa, the second stop on his five-nation Africa trip. Arab television networks today once again played a tape recording of a man claiming to be Saddam Hussein urging Iraqis to resist U.S. and British forces in their country. U.S. officials are downplaying the significance of the new tape, saying it may even be a copy of a recording broadcast earlier. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
The latest tape, according to the Arab television networks that broadcast it, includes the voice of Saddam telling Iraqis, quote, "It is your duty to expel the aggressor invaders from our country." But that quote was also contained in a tape received nearly 2 months ago by a newspaper in Australia. A U.S. official says the latest tape is also similar to a recording broadcast last week on Arab television. The CIA concluded the voice on last week's tape was probably that of Saddam Hussein. An intelligence official says the agency will need 2 or 3 more days to study the latest tape to determine its authenticity. In Baghdad, U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer said he regrets that airing these tapes gives diehard remnants of the old regime the opportunity to tell Iraqis Saddam is still alive and going to come back. Tom Jelton, NPR News, Washington.
Democrats have renewed calls for an investigation into how intelligence information was used before the Iraq War. The new calls come after the Bush administration admitted the president was mistaken when he said in his State of the Union address that Saddam Hussein had tried to buy uranium in Africa. Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle says the admission shows the U.S. had faulty information and that it's time for an investigation. At least 6 people are dead after an employee at a Lockheed Martin airplane plant near Meridian, Mississippi, opened fire on fellow employees today and then killed himself. 8 workers were wounded in the shooting rampage. The Lauderdale County Sheriff says there is no information yet on a possible motive. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials finished up 6 points at 92.23 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 26 at 17.46, and the S&P 500 was up 3 points. This is NPR News. Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas has resigned from the Central Committee of Yasser Arafat's Fatah organization, and he's threatening to quit as prime minister. In a letter to Arafat, Abbas said he'll quit unless he gets clear instructions on how to handle contacts with Israel. Some Fatah officials said Abbas might be trying to gain more flexibility and authority in conducting talks with Israel. In Bakersfield, California, 5 people, 3 young children, their mother and grandmother, were found shot to death early this morning. Authorities are now looking for the mother's estranged husband, an elementary school vice principal. From member station KQED, Tamara Keith reports.
Police in Bakersfield are searching for 41-year-old Vincent Brothers, who they say is a possible suspect. Authorities are not releasing the names of the 5 victims, but say Brothers is the father of the 3 slain children. Brothers has been the vice principal of a local magnet school since 1996. The Bakersfield Californian reports that the victims come from a prominent family and that the grandmother is a well-known local activist who fought against perceived injustice towards blacks by law enforcement. A family friend alerted police in the morning after visiting the home to check on the family. They were last seen at church on Sunday. Police say each person had been shot multiple times. The youngest victim was 2 months old. For NPR News, I'm Tamara Keith in Fresno.
The former police chief of Montgomery County, Maryland, is now free to write a book and pursue a movie deal regarding last fall's Washington, D.C. area sniper case. Charles Moose and the county's Ethics Commission have reached a deal that ends the county's opposition to the book and movie deals. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop features Jazz for Blue Nights and At Home in the World, the first two releases in the I Heard It on NPR CD series, online at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Bennett, is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He's joined us several times to talk about the latest developments in the Middle East. We invited him to discuss the ceasefire that was declared a week ago Sunday by the three major Palestinian groups, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Fatah. But by the time we recorded our interview early this morning, the ceasefire had been broken by a suicide bomber who attacked an Israeli home last night on the West Bank, killing an Israeli woman and injuring three of her grandchildren. A cell of Islamic Jihad claimed responsibility, but the leadership of the group disavowed the attack and said they're still committed to a suspension of violence. I asked James Bennett how much control the leadership has over would-be suicide bombers.
Well, it's interesting. Palestinian and Israeli security officials both say that Hamas and Islamic Jihad have a very high degree of discipline inside the organizations. They're very hierarchical organizations. And as recently as Sunday, senior Israeli security officials were saying that they expected Hamas and Islamic Jihad were more likely to abide by this temporary ceasefire than Fatah, whose Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades organization is somewhat more chaotic, has less direct command and control. So it raises the question as to whether this group that conducted this attack last night was in fact operating autonomously, whether there's some double game being played here, whether Islamic Jihad itself ordered this attack, now wants to be seen as disavowing it and suggesting that it was conducted by a renegade group, or whether they in fact don't have the degree of discipline that Israel itself credits them with.
So how so far is this affecting the peace talks?
Well, it's interesting. The Israeli response so far has been fairly muted to this attack. Israel's position all along has been that this ceasefire was nothing but a ploy, an effort to blunt Israel's army, to restrict its military operations and give these groups time to rearm and regroup. They've been under substantial pressure for some time from Israel now. So Israel didn't put much official stock in this ceasefire to begin with. On the other hand, the area where this occurred, which is in central Israel along the boundary with the northern West Bank, in that area, Israel has not yet withdrawn from the Palestinian areas of the West Bank and retains effective security control. So the Palestinian security forces have not yet taken over there. And while the ceasefire was intended to apply to all attacks against Israel everywhere, according to these groups, the Palestinian security weren't in a position there yet, according to both sides, to really maintain control.
So the Palestinian security can't be blamed for the attack.
Well, they can still be blamed, and Israel is saying this is evidence that they need to take aggressive steps to break apart these groups and take the weapons away from them. Israel is not by no means suggesting that it bears any responsibility for what happened last night, but it makes it a little harder to draw a direct line, I think, between a Palestinian security failure and this particular attack.
Another issue that's threatening the forward motion of the peace talks is the issue of the release of Palestinian prisoners that the Israelis are holding. The Palestinian leadership wants thousands of Palestinian prisoners released by the Israelis. The Israelis have agreed to release several hundred Palestinian prisoners. Why is this such a contentious issue?
Well, it's a deeply emotional issue for both sides in the conflict. For Israelis, these prisoners are terrorists, some, as the Israelis say, or many, with blood on their hands, directly implicated in attacks on Israelis. For Palestinians, many of these same people are freedom fighters. Some of them, they believe, are not implicated in any attack and were simply arrested to create a concession for Israel down the road, that is, their release. So the Palestinians feel that they can't leave these people behind, in essence. The Israelis feel like they can't safely let them go. Both populations are very, very engaged in this issue. It's not an issue necessarily at the leadership level alone. It's really something that brings the publics out into the streets on both sides. It was an issue, by the way, that dogged the Oslo peace process as well. And it's interesting, it's not reflected explicitly in the new peace plan, the so-called roadmap. It wasn't something that the negotiators even dealt with. So it's something that the two sides are coming to grips with on their own, and it's becoming the most significant obstacle at the moment to moving this peace plan forward.
How important is the issue of Palestinian prisoners to the new Palestinian prime minister, who is one of the leading figures in the negotiations on the roadmap? Is he willing to risk stopping the peace talks over this issue?
Well, it's interesting. It's become important to him, I think. And today, startlingly, really, he has canceled or at least postponed talks that were planned for tomorrow with Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of Israel. And the reason he's put forward is this issue of Palestinian prisoners. He had two very difficult meetings last night, one within his own faction, Fatah, the other within the broader umbrella Palestine Liberation Organization with several Palestinian factions, in which he was harshly criticized for moving forward with this peace plan without having secured more concessions from Israel. Specifically on prisoners. Israel said on Sunday that it was going to release about 300, 350 more prisoners, but they fairly narrowly defined the population they were willing to release, favoring people under 18, people over 60, women. The Palestinians want to see many of the long-term prisoners released, including many of the people that Israel says are directly involved in terrorist attacks.
So the next roadmap meeting has been canceled. Is everything off right now, or is this just like one meeting's canceled?
We've seen a fair amount of forward motion in the last few days, including meetings at lower levels between Israeli and Palestinian ministers. We're suddenly seeing a broadening out of the contacts between the two sides. The details of this plan are starting to be filled in by the two sides. That was happening as recently as yesterday. Last night, there was the suicide attack. Today, the slightly paradoxical result is that the Israeli response to the attack is so far at least rather muted. But now the Palestinians are the ones canceling talks, attributing it again to this prisoner issue.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Bennett. He's the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. Well, it's been over a week since the three main Palestinian groups, Fatah, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad, agreed to suspend attacks on Israelis. And you wrote last week that you thought the agreement was based on bad faith, and that ironically that bad faith may actually give it a chance of success. What did you mean by the bad faith?
Well, all these groups are going into this suspension of violence, this declared ceasefire, with, I think, very different interests that reflect the kind of complexity of politics on the Palestinian side. These interests and differences of goals that were, in effect, mooted by the conflict, everybody agreed they were fighting alongside each other against Israel for 33 months. As that conflict perhaps comes to a close, these differences are starting to become apparent once again. Fatah, the mainstream faction, officially is seeking a two-state solution with Israel. Islamic Jihad and Hamas remain officially committed to the destruction of the state of Israel. Mahmoud Abbas, who is the new Palestinian prime minister, has gone far further than the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat ever did in declaring an end to violence, that he seeks unequivocally an end to the armed uprising against Israel. This is arguably not remotely in the interests of Hamas or Islamic Jihad, who don't want to see any kind of negotiated solution and have rejected the idea of negotiation. So the question is, why would they come to this agreement now? Abu Mazen, or Mahmoud Abbas, has made no secret of his desire to turn these other these Islamic groups, Islamic Jihad and Hamas, into political parties inside Palestinian society, preventing them from conducting essentially their own foreign policies towards Israel. So his goal is to get this ceasefire, use it to extract some political concessions from Israel, use those in turn to bolster his own popularity, which remains very limited among Palestinians, and then be in a stronger position to enforce the ceasefire and achieve the goals he wants. I think that Hamas and Islamic Jihad are betting in the other direction, that the ceasefire will fail. They don't want to be seen as responsible for it, because Palestinians really would like to see some progress, I think, don't necessarily share the goals of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And those groups don't want to be seen directly as blowing apart any possibility for an agreement. On the other hand, they would like to be able to have Israel be seen as the villain here, have this negotiation collapse, and see Abu Mazen collapse along with it.
Why does the Palestinian prime minister want Hamas and Islamic Jihad to become political parties?
He's trying to avoid a direct confrontation with those groups, partly because he feels he lacks the strength to have it, partly because he doesn't think that would be supported in the Palestinian street, which posits national unity as the overarching goal. Nobody on that side wants to see a direct conflict, a civil conflict of some sort among Palestinians. So he wants to have their willing cooperation in this ceasefire. For the moment, he's achieved it thanks to some intervention by more popular leaders within his own faction, Fatah.
Are Islamic Jihad and Hamas political parties already, or at least, you know, in part political parties? And does Mahmoud Abbas want them to just give up terrorism and violence, or does he want them to really become a more formal part of the political process?
No, and that's a very important point. They are not political parties now, in that they do not compete within the Palestinian Authority for seats in the Palestinian parliament. They don't compete for the presidency of the Palestinian Authority or the prime ministership, because they regard the PA, the Palestinian Authority, as a creature of the Oslo peace process. They oppose the Oslo peace process essentially as a sellout of Palestinian aspirations and interests. Because they oppose that process, they've always refused to participate, although they've expressed some interest in competing at the local level, where, not coincidentally, they're particularly strong, running for mayoral offices, city councils, things like that. And there was some talk of them beginning to participate in parliamentary elections as well. He wants to see them fully participate, fully engage as political parties. And to a certain degree, he's asking them to put up or shut up. They keep claiming they have so much popularity in the street. The reality is they do have a good deal of popularity, which stems from their networks of health clinics, schools, which are extremely inexpensive, and also the reputation for incorruptibility. Hamas leaders, unlike PA leaders, are not seen as corrupt. They live relatively simply. They tend to live in refugee camps and live among the people, where even Mahmoud Abbas and his Minister of Security, Mohammed Dahlan, both have mansions in the Gaza Strip, in Gaza City, which is a small place and people know where they live. The Hamas leaders are still scattered among the population, and as a result, they're regarded as more devoted in that sense to the people's interests.
What do you think Israel would think of Hamas and Islamic Jihad becoming more a part of the political process?
Well, it depends, I guess, on whether in the end Mahmoud Abbas's second element in that strategy was successful. That is, his hope, I think, of pulling their fangs, that is, getting them to join in the political process and essentially lay their weapons down. Israel doesn't think that's going to happen, because to do that would be essentially for these groups to give up their very reason for existing, which is the notion of establishing some sort of Islamic state in all of historical Palestine and putting an end to the state of Israel. The Israeli security establishment, in any event, doesn't believe that they're willing to take that step. But again, we don't know how dynamic this process is. We don't know whether, if this peace plan moves forward, if life really improves for Palestinians, if the Palestinian Authority is able to reform itself substantially, present itself as not corrupt, as interested in and successful in promoting the welfare of its people, whether support for these other groups will essentially dry up, which is what Mahmoud Abbas is betting.
How are Hamas and Islamic Jihad affected by the war in Iraq? Has that changed their status in any way?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's had a major impact on the conflict here. There's been a direct hit to some of their financing, which came from Iraq, but also the American presence in the region, the new pressure that it's putting directly now on Syria and Iran, sponsors of Hamas, also on Saudi Arabia, very importantly on Saudi Arabia, has had an effect on reigning in Hamas. And it's interesting that the external leadership of the group in Damascus, particularly Khaled Mashal, who's a top leader there based there of Hamas, was very involved in negotiating this ceasefire agreement.
My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He's speaking to us from Jerusalem. Let's talk a little bit about Fatah, the more mainstream Palestinian group that was founded by Yasser Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas, the new Palestinian prime minister. What are some of the things they stand to gain or lose in the roadmap process?
From the outside, this conflict has looked like a sort of continuum, at least on the Palestinian side, of suicidal attacks and different forms of terrorist violence, attacks on soldiers. And in fact, within Palestinian society, there are gradations and shadings that sometimes aren't evident on the outside. Fatah, whose leadership officially favors a two-state solution with Israel, has been divided internally over the course of the conflict over what sorts of violence the faction should embrace. That is, whether it should confine its attacks only to the West Bank and Gaza Strip, which Israel occupied during the 1967 Six-Day War, or whether it should conduct attacks in what is known as pre-1948 Israel. The argument was that by focusing only on the occupied territories, on soldiers and settlers there, they would make clear that their goal was only to achieve a state in those territories and to end the occupation. What happened over the course of the conflict was that Fatah increasingly became embroiled not just in the conflict with Israel, but in a sort of tit-for-tat competition with Hamas to see which group could conduct the most sensational attacks. Beginning in January, really, of 2002, Fatah began conducting attacks across the so-called Green Line, which is the 1967 boundary. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which is a violent offshoot of Fatah, began conducting suicide attacks as well, which used to be the province only of the really Islamist groups, Hamas and Islamic Jihad. So, in a sense, the violence of these groups became indistinguishable. And to Israelis, this seemed that Fatah was now bent on the same goal as the other groups, which was the extermination of Israel itself. At the same time, during this period, a rising generation of Fatah leaders would get growing increasingly concerned that they'd essentially lost control of the faction's message and its youth, that this Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade was a chaotic organization made up of some ideologues, some true believers, some ex-car thieves, conducting a kind of anarchic war against Israel. And they began looking for a way to rein them in and to clarify what the faction's goals were. I think Mahmoud Abbas is now essentially at the spearhead of that effort to try to once again refine, if you will, Fatah's message and to try to re-engage. This is a very important part of his strategy, to try to re-engage the Israeli center, to reassure Israeli leftists and moderates that, in fact, there are Palestinians that are willing or have accepted the idea of a two-state solution.
Well, what could Mahmoud Abbas do to try to rein in the Al-Aqsa Brigades, the Martyrs' Brigades?
It's something of an open question how much control the leadership of Fatah has over the Al-Aqsa Martyrs' Brigades. Mahmoud Abbas himself has almost none. Yasser Arafat has far more influence as the symbol and the guy who, at least for most of the conflict, controlled most of the money going to those groups. That doesn't mean even Israeli security officials say that he could simply turn it off, and they've anticipated that despite the truce agreement, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs will continue to conduct attacks, as indeed they have, particularly in the northern West Bank, sniper attacks on roads in the West Bank, and things like that. So what he's done is turned to some other influential leaders within Fatah, in particular Marwan Barghouti, who was jailed by Israel more than a year ago and is a young and fairly popular leader within the faction who was very involved in negotiating the truce agreement and, in effect, lent his imprimatur to it. That's had something of an effect on these groups, I think.
Yeah, Marwan Barghouti has been in an Israeli prison for over a year. The Israelis allowed him to participate in peace talks recently. Were you surprised that the Israelis let him do that?
It is interesting. I mean, the contacts were made through his lawyers who have the right to visit him and were shuffling messages back and forth, but there were other contacts that the people who were involved, Barghouti's emissaries, did not want to describe that I think required some Israeli cooperation. Essentially, he dispatched two emissaries to Damascus to meet with the leadership there of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and it was that group that really hammered out this truce agreement in the end. Mahmoud Abbas was not entirely happy with it in the end, I think, partly because Barghouti got so much of the credit for it. So it's interesting that at this kind of critical moment, Israel, which remained officially very much opposed to this ceasefire, was nevertheless willing to use Marwan Barghouti, or at least permit him to be used, to achieve it.
James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times, speaking to us from a studio in Jerusalem. Our interview was recorded earlier today. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the new role of the Bush administration in the Middle East peace process. We continue our interview with James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And Ken Tucker continues his series on the latest in pop rock. He reviews Redhead by the musician known as Blue. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of the interview we recorded earlier today with James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times. He spoke to us from a studio in Jerusalem about the Middle East peace process and the latest setbacks. When we left off, we were talking about the new Palestinian Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas. He opposes the continuation of violence. The statements that he's recently made include, "Our struggle, the Palestinian struggle, is a political struggle which we will end through diplomatic means. We have no hostility toward the Israeli people, and we have no interest in continuing the struggle with you." And then he said, he renounced terror against the Israelis wherever they may be. Are these new positions for him?
He has been known to be a critic throughout the Intifada of the armed Intifada. The two have considered it to have been a disaster for the Palestinians. He broke with Yasser Arafat over the conduct of this conflict, but he did it very quietly. He was, in a sense, sulking in his tent. He was in Ramallah. He was in the Gulf. He was sort of out of sight for most of the conflict, maintaining some of his contacts with the Israeli peace camp, continuing to go abroad and talk to diplomats overseas. But he wasn't an active presence until he was essentially revived as this peace plan started to come into focus into recent months. And he's stepped forward and taken these positions publicly now, which are far ahead, I think, it's safe to say, of where most of his people are. Last week, the comments that you just quoted, he made in a joint appearance with Ariel Sharon here in Jerusalem. And the imagery of that appearance, it was as striking, I think, as the words. Ariel Sharon was taking something of a political risk in meeting with any Palestinian leader, of course, as well. But Ariel Sharon remains the dominant politician now in Israel. His popularity is quite strong. His faction is in very strong control of his government. Abbas, on the other hand, does not have that kind of strength. And he appeared side by side with Ariel Sharon, standing at a podium that was decorated with a menorah, one of the symbols of the State of Israel. He laughed at Ariel Sharon's jokes. The two men looked quite comfortable with each other. They shook one another's hands warmly. It was very, very powerful imagery within Israel. Israelis were really struck by it, even some, I think, moved by it. Palestinians, I think, were a little discomfited, some of them, by it. And I think it was perhaps a great exercise of leadership on his part, also maybe a great political risk. It's too soon really to judge, but it's very interesting in light of that, of how comfortable the two leaders seemed with each other a week ago, that all of a sudden Prime Minister Abbas today feels the need to cancel the meeting that was planned for tomorrow with Ariel Sharon.
Does Arafat himself have any real power in the current negotiations for peace?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very interesting that Israeli officials who have tended for quite some time to talk about how influential Yasser Arafat is, to talk about how involved he is in the process and how much trouble he's causing, lately have been all but silent on the question of Yasser Arafat. There have been many fewer stories than we usually see in the Israeli press. The issue has been somewhat soft-pedaled, I think, because they're trying to avoid emphasizing this split between Yasser Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas in an effort to bolster Mahmoud Abbas. They don't want to complicate his life, I think, by suggesting that there is this division and that they're betting on the one guy and against the other. So they're talking less about him, but that doesn't mean he's not intimately involved. He is. Mahmoud Abbas reports to him constantly. He still retains effective control of at least half, I think, of the Palestinian security forces, the leadership of the various branches. Many of those leaders still report to him. Many of the ministers in the government that Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, formed report as well to Yasser Arafat. So he's very involved.
You were saying that a lot of the Israeli leadership was very skeptical of the truce that the Palestinian groups called a week ago Sunday. The truce has been broken already, but it's still officially in effect. Ariel Sharon has been a hardliner throughout his political career. Why do you think he is willing to take the risk that he has taken so far to go forward with the roadmap?
Well, the Israelis are also under significant pressure from Washington. They were very reluctant to proceed with the roadmap. The government did not want to endorse this approach. The Americans pushed and pushed, and ultimately Israel agreed while putting forward certain conditions, which the Americans said that they would entertain along the road. So far, at least, the roadmap is unfolding, at least in the short term, at least in the steps we've seen in these early days, along the lines that Israel had demanded. That is, security remains first and foremost the issue that's being negotiated between the two sides. The Israelis are pulling back slowly from what, by previous agreement under the Oslo Accords, were Palestinian-controlled areas of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. So far, the Israelis have pulled their troops back from parts of the Gaza Strip and from most of Bethlehem. They've yet to evacuate any of the other West Bank cities where they've taken positions over the course of the fighting in the last year. And Israel is demanding that the Palestinians take the measures that Israel has always asked for from them, which are to dismantle, as they say, the terrorist infrastructure, in effect drive Hamas and Islamic Jihad out of business, close their training centers, close their bomb laboratories, arrest their dangerous members, collect their weapons. Those are the steps they want to see these groups take. At the same time, Israel has made one of the concessions called for under the plan, which is to dismantle some of these so-called settlement outposts, these sort of hilltop groupings of trailers and tents that settlers have put up over the course of the conflict to extend their presence in the West Bank. Israel has begun taking some of those down. New ones are going up almost as fast or faster even than the old ones are coming down.
Ariel Sharon, the Israeli prime minister, used the word occupation in late May. He said, "You may not like the word, but what's happening is occupation. Holding 3.6 million Palestinians under occupation is a bad thing for Israel, for the Palestinians, and for the Israeli economy." What has been the impact on Israel for Sharon to have actually used the word occupation to describe the Israeli presence in the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, it's a really astonishing moment, because his own government, his own foreign ministry, was working to change the use of the term occupation, challenging the use of the word occupation, trying to change it to disputed territories rather than recognizing this concept. Ariel Sharon has not used the word since then because the backlash was so severe within his own faction. Essentially, what Ariel Sharon legitimated, not just in the eyes of Israel's left, but really in the eyes, I think, of most political analysts here, was the notion that Israel couldn't hold on to all of the West Bank and Gaza, that it was going to have to give up some of these territories. He had talked about territorial concession before, but he had not used this language of occupation before, which suggested that Israel was actually doing something wrong, morally wrong, in holding on to this land. He has spoken repeatedly, even when he hasn't talked again, he specifically used the word occupation. He said it is simply not in Israel's interest to continue to control more than 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, that Israel has to address that problem, and that this peace plan is a way to do that. And I should add, though, in doing this, Ariel Sharon once again positioned himself very much in the political center in Israel. He perhaps hardened this consensus viewpoint, but he was also joining what was already, I think, a hardening viewpoint of the majority of Israelis, about the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
My guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Bennett, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. When President Bush first came to the White House, he basically withdrew America from the Middle East peace process, and he criticized President Clinton for having become so personally involved in it. Now the Bush administration is deeply involved in the Middle East peace process. What are you hearing from the Israelis and Palestinians, from the leadership on each side behind the scenes, about their perception of the Bush administration's motives for this new involvement?
I should say first that there was a real sense of surprise, I think, here on both sides, on all sides, that the administration was engaging as deeply as it was. The Israelis also, who had obviously much better connections than the Bush administration to the Bush administration going into this process than the Palestinians did, were uncertain even on the eve of the Iraq war as to what the end game would be, whether after Iraq the Bush administration would, as it was then suggesting, turn its attention here or not. They've discovered that, in fact, the Bush administration was very serious about focusing on this problem. And they think, both sides say, the focus is quite intense for now. The Palestinians had essentially lost all connection with the Bush White House over the course of the conflict, and one of Mahmoud Abbas's top goals was to try to resume those contacts. That was why he, I think, was willing to go as far as he was in the joint summit that took place with President Bush a month ago in Jordan in the port city of Aqaba. He went quite far in calling for an end to the armed uprising, using language that the Americans had demanded from him, because he was, I think, his first constituency in that summit was the Bush White House. He really wanted to resume those ties, and the Palestinians feel that they have now done so. They've been surprised by the level of the American involvement. President Bush has sent a new envoy of sorts to the region, John Wolfe, who is in charge of putting a monitoring team together. He's been assembling a staff. They've been bringing in armored cars. They're getting quite involved in the details of putting this agreement into action. And it's very interesting. One of the things the Palestinians really wanted to see happen as part of the initial stages of the roadmap was an agreement from Israel to stop its so-called targeted killings, its preemptive killings of people it accused of being on the way to terrorist attack or planning such attacks. These are the helicopter missile strikes, gun attacks, other things we've seen in the West Bank and Gaza over the last couple of years. The agreement that's been hammered out between the two sides is that Israel has not forsworn those sorts of attacks, but it's essentially agreed to give the Palestinian Authority first crack. It will inform the Palestinian Authority when it has intelligence that such an attack is underway, wait to see if the PA acts, and then it may take action itself if it doesn't. The interesting element here is that they have also agreed to inform the Americans, which could put the Americans in the position of essentially green-lighting or red-lighting Israeli action, which would involve the Americans to a degree that the Clinton administration certainly never was involved in Middle East peacemaking here, not just Middle East peacemaking, but Middle East violence.
Condoleezza Rice is now President Bush's personal representative in the Middle East. How is she regarded by both sides?
She made her first visit here a week and a half ago as a presidential envoy on this issue. And because she was seen as the president's direct emissary here, both sides were very, very eager to make a good impression. She arrived on a Saturday night, and I think it was no coincidence that the stalemates on two fronts broke. The logjam here really broke around the time of her visit. You saw the next day the Palestinian factions came forward with this ceasefire announcement that they'd essentially been negotiating for months. And at the meantime, the Israelis and Palestinians agreed just the day before she arrived on a plan to begin this phased withdrawal by Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Both these things happened, I think, or both were driven forward by the fact that she was coming and everybody wanted to make a good impression. She wasn't regarded as necessarily as someone who was deeply versed in the issues here, but she was seen as someone with a direct line to the President of the United States.
One of the rationales for the United States invasion of Iraq was that the United States could get rid of Saddam Hussein, help create a democracy in Iraq, and that other Arab countries would admire this new democracy and they would want something like that for themselves, and democracy would begin to spread across the Middle East, which would be an influence for peace in the region. Instead, right now, what we're seeing in Iraq is anarchy. The infrastructure is still destroyed. There's banditry, kidnapping, sniping at the U.S. troops. How is this anarchic phase within Iraq affecting the Middle East and, affecting what's supposed to be like the positive bounce from the war in Iraq?
Well, if the chaos continues or grows in Iraq, then I think it certainly will have an impact here. The Israelis say it'll embolden Hamas and make them feel freer to break the ceasefire again. Both sides, I think it could wind up distracting the Bush administration's attention substantially from this conflict, that they'll have other problems to solve elsewhere, that they won't be able to continue the kind of high-level pressure that they've put on in the last couple of weeks to drive the process forward, that they could essentially lose interest here. You know, it's interesting. Palestinians, particularly Palestinian intellectuals and some Palestinian politicians, and there's some overlap between those two categories, do make this argument that Palestinian society is particularly suited for this kind of democratic experiment, one that was already conducted to some extent under the Oslo process, partly because of the proximity to Israel and the example of Israeli democracy. They watch Israeli media. Many Palestinians speak some Hebrew. They watch the TV. They see the debate in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. But also because of Palestinians' own diaspora. Many Palestinians worked in the United States. They worked in Western European countries. They saw what life was like there. And they also have worked and lived in the Gulf states, and they've traveled to Egypt, and they've seen the example in the other direction of some of these Arab governments, and they've reached a conclusion that they're more interested in the kind of democratic model that they may have seen in the United States.
Since the truce was declared a week ago Sunday, you have been to the West Bank, you've been to Gaza, you've been, you know, in Israel. Is travel any different right now than it was before that ceasefire?
It isn't different for Palestinians trying to leave those areas. Within Gaza, Palestinians are able to move more freely now than they really have been over the course of the 33-month conflict. The Israelis have eased or removed checkpoints along the main north-south road. I was there the day they did it, and it was somewhat amazing. All Gaza seemed to be in motion by whatever conveyance people could find, from donkey carts to rollerblades to luxury German sedan, kind of racing up and down this road. And in Bethlehem, again, the Israelis are gone from the center of town, but there are less of a presence there. And as a result, people in Bethlehem feel less of a difference. They're no more free to leave Bethlehem than they were before the Israelis pulled back. In fact, they say that new checkpoints have gone up. Roads are even more tightly patrolled and blocked off than they were before, so they still feel equally enclosed. And it shows one of the problems, one of the pitfalls, really, of this plan, because Palestinians in most of these West Bank towns, while they would like to see the Israelis withdraw from the centers, what they most want to be able to do is to travel freely within the West Bank, to also be able to travel freely to Jerusalem again, to cross the limits of their towns. But the Israelis say they can't afford to remove essentially their blockades around these towns because of the risk of suicide bombing.
Well, James Bennett, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
James Bennett is the Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke to us from a studio in Jerusalem. Our interview was recorded earlier today. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker continues his series on the resurgence of pop rock with the new CD, Blue. This is Fresh Air. As part of rock critic Ken Tucker's mini-series about the current resurgence of pop rock, he's reviewing the new CD, Blue, spelled the French way, B-L-E-U. Blue is the adopted name for William McCauley, a Boston-based musician who alternately performs with a full backup band or gives solo performances that simulate the same effect via electronic samples, sound effects, and tape loops. Ken says that on Blue's new album called Redhead, he uses a combination of these two strategies to great effect.
We had a moment, we had a long talk, we had a few laughs, we had a night off, we had a few drinks, we happened so fast. Before I noticed, we had a sofa. I know, we had a few fights. I didn't see why we had to say bye. I'm doing fine. My friends all say so. I'm doing all right. But that don't mean dick unless you know. I know.
Who's the nerviest wimp in current pop music? No, it's not American Idol's Clay Aiken. It's William McCauley, who's blue in more ways than one. On Redhead, he's created a concept album about a guy who whines to, rages at, and peeps on a woman who obviously dumped him for doing all that stuff. Embedded in lush melodies, loamy with layered guitars, and rich, multi-track vocals, Blue's Redhead is a sustained meditation on romantic obsession.
Since you left me, I've been almost fine. Back to normal, back to boring life. Drama's over since we don't.
These are the protestations of a guy who doth protest too much. On that song, Something's Gotta Give, sung with an uncanny John Lennon-esque edge in his voice, Blue begins by saying that since his girls left him, he's feeling fine, quote, back to normal. Then the creepiness begins to creep in. The phrase, drama's over since we dulled that shine, is a tip-off that he's a guy who gets off on high-maintenance relationships. Then he runs into his ex's mother at the mall, who tells him she misses having him around the house. He's telling this to his ex-girlfriend, using her own mother, hoping to instill guilt. Yeah, like that's gonna work as a strategy to get her back.
The street light winds through my cheap Venetian blinds. The hip-hop beats will not go to sleep. So I slip outside and go stalking in the night. 'Cause I don't know what to do about my life. So I'm watching you sleep right outside your window, inches away from sleeping with you. And you
okay, now we're getting into the really disturbing stuff. Very pretty song, isn't it? But the first verse has the line, "So I slip outside and go stalking in the night because I don't know what to do with my life." He says he's, quote, "right outside your window, inches away from sleeping with you." Time to get a restraining order, as long as Blue can bring all his recording equipment to keep making such music.
What if I was all right? What if I wasn't bound so tight? What if I had the balls to be bad? Could you still look at me like that? Would you be mad that I had held the only back? Why can't I be somebody else? Somebody who isn't too cool to believe it's okay to be just me.
By the end of this album, Blue is sublimating his frustration with a rubber blow-up doll until he's blue in the face and elsewhere. "What if I wasn't wound so tight," he muses miserably on somebody else. Well, you may have gotten the girl, Blue, but you probably wouldn't have made this squirmily gorgeous album.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the new CD, Redhead, by Blue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
I was totally cool with the way things were going. Wasn't moving too fast, but my speed wasn't slowing. Ducks in a row, nice and easy. I was fine with the fact that my heart wasn't showing. I was figuring half of the battle was knowing that we can go down nice and easy. But then you let me in your house and threw me on your yellow couch. You grabbed my hand and then you made me wonder when we'll do it all again. We'll do it all again. Stumble and fall, then do it all again. We were doing okay when we lived in the moment, but a moment is only as long as you're holding.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation, by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, private military firms, companies that the U.S. has hired to build army bases, supply food, maintain weapon systems, rebuild oil wells, and build the prisons in Guantanamo Bay. Drug cartels and dictators have used their services, too. We talk with Peter Singer, author of Corporate Warriors. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.